Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators, and we've all worked in the industry for about the last 25 years. We've all worked with just about every major publisher in the business and worked for just about every major publication. We've published somewhere between 50 and 100 books together. And we've all taught illustration at university.
Each week we come up with a new topic in illustration. Sometimes we agree. Most of the time we fight. But each time you guys learn something brand spanking new.
That's right. And we made it. We made it to the end of 2020. We're still alive. We're still breathing.
We're so staggering across the finish line like someone who didn't train for a marathon.
Let me ask you this. Do you think... the worst of it is behind us, or do you think 2021 is going to be just as stressful and awkward and hard?
Well, we haven't encountered the lava monsters yet. You do know about those, right?
Lava monsters are on the way.
Yeah.
I anticipate. Well, let me ask you this: I know we got some questions to get into, but I just want to say, how was your year career wise?
Go ahead,
Lee.
Thank you, Will Terry. Terry's being nice right here at the end of the year.
Is somebody like making steel drums in the background at one of your places, by the way?
Not mine.
I keep hearing the crashes.
So it's got to be Jake.
Nothing's happening here.
10 kids. Hold on.
Did you see how he said that? Nope, nothing's happening here. Can't be me.
At the risk of sounding, I don't know how I want to sound, but some people didn't end up worse off because of what happened in 2020. There was a lot of people that were poised to do better because, I mean, I think what happens in situations like what happened in 2020 is some people shifted and they were in the right spot and made it work. Other people were vulnerable to what happened and they were completely exposed with the way that it happened, if that makes any sense. A restaurant or something else where you have to go sit down. They're totally exposed, you know, once the lockdowns happen and all that stuff, they struggle. But, you know, artists, for the most part, are, you know, single, sole proprietors. There are a lot of people work at home or just have a singular studio. There's not a lot of stuff happening. And for people who are already positioned online, the whole world moved online. So our business has been robust over the course of this year because we positioned ourselves for the last 5-6 years to be in that spot.
Yeah. Do you think that, well, I'll say this, I've turned down recently, 3 jobs that were decent jobs. And I've been blessed to be able to do that, to not need that, you know, like, the projects that I'm working on are more important. But do you think in general that the freelance field has it expanded? Has it contracted? Has it stayed the same? Where do you guys see that?
I think it's expanded.
I'm curious about publishing because I don't know if this thing has hurt publishing or helped publishing because bookstores are closed, but then again, people have more time or have had more time to read. So maybe, you know, libraries are closed. So I'm guaranteed libraries haven't been buying books to replace.
Because they're not, the reason why libraries buy books is because they wear out.
Right.
And if they're not sending books out, the books aren't wearing out. So yeah.
I don't think that's a big driver of book sales. I think it's a big driver of, in terms of libraries buying them. I think the libraries, when they stock stuff, all of a sudden will drive sales because people see the books and then all of a sudden they start giving it to other people and all that. But I don't think the library.
If you're a Caldecott winner or an honor winner, if you have a bestseller that everybody wants, don't you think that, because I've heard that big libraries will place the same book as many as 3 or 4 times a year, buying 3 or 4 of those books. And you have, I believe there's 120,000 libraries in the country, in the U.S. For some people, it's a substantial amount of their income.
I shouldn't have pulled my book out of the Caldecott running this year then.
Why'd you do that, by the way?
It was a guaranteed win. And I just said, no, I don't like this year.
I mean, libraries are one component, but another component is schools and book fairs. And there's an article posted about Scholastic having huge financial problems because they weren't doing book fairs.
Yeah. And that's a big part of their model.
How did Scholastic just get it? I mean, it's a sort of side note, but they, I mean, I remember from when I was in grade school that it was Scholastic. Even then, how did they get that gig and nobody else is kind of
They were smart at? Early on.
Yeah. Why is there not a Random House book fair or a Simon & Schuster book fair?
Well, and the other books run theirs through Scholastic, so Random House will run their books in there.
It probably is a huge pain in the rear end to run that thing. And so if I was another publisher, I was like, oh, you guys want to do that? Yeah, well, let's just, how about you carry this book of mine?
Yeah, take a percentage.
I'll take whatever cut. That'd be interesting. So there's that. And then I also know, you know, for artists, like if you look at entertainment, anything live action has been decimated. Like nobody's shooting anything live action.
Oh yeah.
All those art departments. What's that?
My shows all got canceled.
Yeah.
My comic convention shows.
Yeah.
Any sort of live events, those types of things. But you threw me off there. I was talking about entertainment industry, not Comic Cons. We'll get to Comic Cons.
I thought shows like what you're talking about, Jake, have thrived because it seems like everything's moving to that platform because everybody's just at home. And so,
right. But how do you film a new episodes if you can't have anybody on set, you know? Mm-hmm. So unless you're a well-funded show, right? You're not going to get, you know, they're going to figure out how to do Mandalorian, right? Because Disney Plus reported 100 million subscribers in their third quarter.
Wow.
They're leaning into that. That said, on the animation side, the video game side, all these things are contingent on not having actors in a studio. They bring, you know, these things can all be done remotely. And I've talked to so many people who work in animation. They're like, yeah, I've just been working from home. They sent my stuff, my computer, my workstation home. You know, we're not going to go back until 2021, if that, you know. And we're just doing Zoom meetings all day. And we haven't really skipped a beat. The main thing that is lost in that is the, you know, the hallway meetings or the popping in by someone's desk. Hey, can you just look at this really quick? And you kind of lose that because you have to schedule a Zoom call now, right?
Right.
So it's interesting. I think as an artist, if you've already been somewhat independent, you know, working from home, freelancing, chances are, depending on what field you're working for, you didn't see any change in your work. I remember for me personally, I was kind of jealous of all these people I knew, neighbors who were like, yeah, I had to come home. My office has no idea how to do remote work. So we're just kind of hanging out for a month, figuring out what's going on. And yeah, I'm like, you get a month vacation paid. Meanwhile, I'm slaving with the kids at home with.
Actually worse for us at being at home. I remember seeing a great little comic on Facebook or Instagram, wherever, that said, artists before 2020, and it was just a shot of a person at a desk, and then artists during 2020, and it's the same shot both times.
Exactly.
You know? And it was so appropriate and accurate, right. I thought.
Right. Anyway, I didn't want to get into that too much, but looking back at 2020, there were lessons learned. There were things that could be improved upon. There are things that went great. And I'm personally looking forward to 2021, seeing I definitely see a shift in my personal work where I'm wanting to do a little bit more, less inking stuff, less line work stuff, and more illustrative digital type of stuff. So
why is that?
Here's what I'm thinking. If if we're going into, you know, so I had a career during the recession, 2008 recession, right? I had a career in animation, and all of us were kind of worried that, like, oh, you know, are people going to stop going to see movies? Mm-hmm. Nobody stopped going to see movies. If anything, when people lost their house, lost their job, like, they needed that diversion, right? Mm-hmm. They needed something to, like, take them out of their moment. And so the entertainment industry has blossomed since then, especially now with streaming. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now we have Netflix, we've got Hulu, we've got Apple TV, we've got Disney Plus, we've got, I don't know, 500 other, you know, smaller different streaming services. And they're all, you know, posting, like, record profits. They're all, you know, subscriptions are all up. And so I'm looking at what I do for a living, and I work in publishing. I work in online. We do online courses, mm-hmm. and I have an online shop, and then I do freelance work, right? So those are kind of like the four table legs. And when I don't know, but I feel like we might go into, it's possible we could go into another recession of some kind. Who knows? Things are just so unstable now. Who knows what could happen? Mm-hmm. If that's the case and people have less expendable income, what are they going to get rid of first? Are they going to cut Disney Plus, or are they going to stop buying children's books? You know, are they going to cut Netflix, or are they maybe going to do less online learning, right? Mm. Are they going to back a Kickstarter? If the choice is back this Kickstarter or turn off Amazon Prime, they're probably going to keep Amazon Prime. You know, it's
yeah, you only have so many dollars, so you have to sort of allocate right. them.
So that means, and with Disney posting that, because our theme parks are closed, because no one's going to movie theaters, we're going to lean in hard on Disney Plus and just create content for streaming. Yeah. And so if you're going to create content for streaming, you're going to need creators to help make those things. So I'm anticipating staffing up, you know, in all these animation studios, maybe new studios popping up to help meet the demand. So maybe my portfolio shifts to, or my work shifts to, I take on one less children's book job, or I take on one less, you know, Kickstarter, and I replace it with freelance work for these studios.
Because everybody's going to be working at home.
Yeah, everyone's working at home anyway, so it's less of a, you know, they have the infrastructure there in place now, or at least the psychological understanding. Mm-hmm. Like, who cares if Jake's in Arizona? Everyone else I'm dealing with every day is at home too, you know?
Right. I've heard that there's going to be a big drought on new movies coming up. I mean, it's obvious, yeah. right?
I mean,
so animation is probably going to fill in some of that.
That's what I think. And I mean, if you are a Hollywood studio right now and you've got the option to do a $200 million blockbuster Marvel movie, which you have to post it, you have to put it in theaters in order to make that money back. Are you going to do that? Or are you going to do, you know, a $60 million animated movie that you can release on a streaming right. platform and easily recoup that. I mean, again, I don't know everything. I'm not the most educated person in this, but from my sort of side chair, what is that called? Armchair backseat, like, prognostications here. This is my understanding of how things could be.
Well, can I add, this is a little non sequitur, but piggybacks on this topic. Let's talk about animation in the United States. If a bunch of new animations are going to be made this year, and studio executives are listening to this podcast exclusively mm-hmm. to see what we think before they make something.
Yeah, one in five studio executives listens to Three-Point Perspective.
The animations that get made here are ridiculous in the United States. And here's what I've noticed compared to the other animations in different countries. Every animation here involves somebody wanting to take over the world. It's not even just a small goal. They just want to be in control of the entire planet, and they have an evil plan to do it. It's just so big. And we were watching a movie the other day. It's that new one. What's it called? Glenn Keane produced it.
Oh, yeah. I forget the name.
What's it called?
Well,
it's Over the Moon.
Okay, yeah.
And
where was it on? What was it on? Amazon?
It was one of those. Either Amazon or Netflix. One of those.
Okay.
It was just trying so hard to be huge. And what I've noticed, you know, you go to like a Miyazaki film or something else, that these films that are so satisfying is that the moments that they're showing and the relationships in the movies they're showing, they're very small. Mm-hmm. And they're just, it's just a different scale. And then so all of a sudden I started looking at the American movies that animations have come out, like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and all these movies, and everything's this climactic giant thing where the whole world is impacted by somebody who wants power, you know, Megamind, and I don't know, it's weird, it's just so consistent.
And I'm not sure who's driving that, if it's the audiences or if it's the like studio executives who think that's what audiences want. Or if it's creators thinking that's what audiences want. I don't know who is driving that exactly. I mean, you look at, the exception of the rule would be like Pixar. Like you look at Inside Out. No one's trying to take over the world there.
Perfectly. And that was so entertaining too. It was very enjoyable to watch. And it didn't have that component. I mean, it's almost the exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm. What was there? Oh, Toy Story. You know, any of the Toy Story films is very much a very personal thing, but they draw so much inspiration from Miyazaki films. Mm. I mean, Totoro is a character now in the Toy Story movies, right?
Oh, really?
He's one of the toys, one of the stuffed animals, right? What's interesting is I found myself one afternoon at a meeting at CAA, which is one of the big entertainment agencies in LA. And I was pitching an idea for a film based on Little Bot and Sparrow. And so I was just throwing it, like I was showing him artwork, and it's, you know, it's about this robot, and he's going on this very like personal journey. This essentially he's trying to figure out his origin. And it's very sweet. There is adventure a part of it, you know, he gets caught up in situations out of his control and meets all these different characters. And so I kind of threw it out there and they're like, this is really cool. It looks great, but it needs to have this element you're talking about. Is he going to stop like somebody from taking over the world? Is he going to be like the instrumental in, you know, keeping an invasion from happening and, you know, right, in the countryside or something like that? And I'm like, really? That's what you guys want? They're like, yeah, work on that a little bit more and come back to us. And I never worked on it and I never went back to them.
That's hilarious. It just seems like a go-to. I mean, once you start to look at American animation through that lens, how many of them just have that component?
Right. And it's no disrespect to them. They're just like, we know what sells. And if we're going to be able to sell this thing, it's got to have this element to it.
Mm.
And if you don't want to do that element, then you're not going to sell it, you know, if you don't want to have that part of it. But I think, you know, who knows, entertainment's getting more and more diverse because there's easier ways to distribute stuff without spending a lot of money, you mm-hmm. know?
So and that brings up a good question, because it's like you, and this is a problem with publishing, with children's publishing. It's a problem with animation, with games, with everything. And that is the idea that the studios or publishers dictate what is wanted. Like this isn't wanted, that we can't sell this until someone somehow breaks the mold and does it. And it becomes really successful. And then all the studios are like, well, now that's what we want. something that fits in that genre. So how do you, as a small creator, rise above that? If you have a really creative idea that you think people would really resonate with and really like, but you're getting told no by the gatekeepers, what are your options?
I mean, sidestep the gatekeepers is one thing.
Yeah, you got to get rid of the gatekeepers, because the publishing industry, to round this back to what we do in books, is they're the same way. Like, all of a sudden, you know, I remember pitching some books and all of a sudden they're asking me to put a bully in there. And it wasn't even about that. You know what I mean? And, and so, you know, publishing has its, like, you know, couple of buzzwords that all of a sudden, okay, that's what's selling this year. So no matter what story you come to them with, you got to kind of shoehorn this other thing in there, like a bully or, you know, whatever's hot, the flavor of the month in publishing. Mm-hmm. And the actual story doesn't come out that you want it to. So I agree with you. The gatekeeper has been the gatekeeper. They've been stopping the projects from coming through. And I love these alternate forms. The other thing I like about that is that you don't need to please everybody the entire time. Right. Smaller audience.
Is it possible for anyone to, and this is me, I'm totally ignorant on this. Is it possible for an artist or a group of artists to make an animation, a full-length animation, and get it on the Disney Channel or get it on, you know, a streaming service like Prime? Is it even possible, or do you have to have a lot of money?
For feature animation, I don't know how to do it for, you know, without millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at something like Klaus, which came out last Christmas.
Oh, that was so good.
Yeah, so good. Traditionally animated, it costs a fraction of what was being done, you know, at Disney or at Pixar. It looked great. You know, some people didn't even know if it was traditionally like 2D animation, but they pioneered, I don't know if they pioneered it, but they leveraged some kind of technology to make it look more dimensional. And that was made somewhat independently, and it did, you could do it, but you're essentially, like three guys working out of a garage, making a feature length animated film. That's going to take years to do. I don't know if that's quite possible, but what could happen is you can make an animated short, sort of a proof of content, concept, and then get some sort of studio, you know, to want to do this, you know, get funding to hire a studio to do this sort of thing, and then get it delivered. I think of the people who are doing something all by themselves, like a one person thing. And I look at like Lucas the Spider. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but it's on YouTube. And this guy, I don't know, he's done 15, 20 Lucas the Spider episodes, and they're a minute each long, but he comes out with maybe three a year and they're fully rendered. They look, you know.
Oh, I have seen these.
Yeah, it's super adorable and cute. And he just records the audio. I think his kid plays the audio. But look at how many subscribers his YouTube channel has. Look at how many views these videos have. He can go off and he could sell Lucas the Spider t-shirts and plushies and things like that. Mm-hmm. And does it have to be more than that? Does it have to be a feature-length film? Mm, like, would a Lucas the Spider feature-length film be entertaining? Like,
how profitable do you think he is?
Right. Right. Everything doesn't always have to be 2 hours. It can be 30 minutes and be more appropriate at 30 minutes than 2 hours. I mean, look at the Polar Express. They tried to take a simple children's book idea and move it into 2 hours. Sort of a disaster.
Yeah. Some of these YouTube channels that do animation, like 2D simple animation, just essentially, I don't know what their program they're using, but it looks like old school Flash animation. They have tremendous audiences, 10 million subscribers, 20 million subscribers, wow, something like that. And if they go to sell a t-shirt, they're making 100K in t-shirt sales, you know, that weekend, right? So the business model, I think, works for that sort of independent creation and making short form content that is easily digestible. And I think that's the route you go, unless you want, if you want to tell a long form, like theatrical style story, you're going to need money and you're going to need people to help you do that. Unless you're drawing like a graphic novel or writing a book or something like that, you know, that's the opinion of Jake.
Well, it's, you know, I think the, one of the reasons why I asked that is because it to me, it's funny that we're, as artists, as illustrators, we, and I've said this so many different times, we are the one group of artists that tend to not want to risk as much as the others, as I see it. Writers that are wanting to write commercially have to take a risk that they're going to write something that will never be published, right? So they're very, in a lot of ways, entrepreneurial. They have to create something without any promise of success. Same with musicians that are writing music, right? Same with small game companies that are putting out a game. There's a creation process there that has to occur without any guarantee of success or a certain amount of compensation. And then you take illustrators who are like, well, I'm not working unless there's a contract, you know? And my thought is you should always be working or having a dream project that could end up being the thing that's going to help you financially break through to where you don't worry about money anymore. I mean, like that's the dream, right? That we all have is to be financially independent so we can create the kinds of things that we want to create.
And I don't know if we all have that dream.
We should.
That is some people. And I don't know if we should. Like some people are more than happy.
I think, but at the same time, well, should, however you want to phrase it, I think I'm going to challenge everyone, every artist, to retool their thinking to allow that as a possibility that you can have you know, we're all working for people who had a dream. Don't you have a dream? Don't you?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like,
but not everybody is a Walt Disney, you know.
There's
some people who are more than happy to be a part of a team and that fulfills them. And I've been that person too. You know, like I'm just going to work on this one piece. I want to make it the best I can make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm happy with the overall outcome. Maybe I'm not happy with the overall outcome, but I could stand by the work that I did, you know.
Call it an invitation then. It's an invitation to think differently.
Just ponder it. I like ponder that. It.
Yeah.
Okay. But let me ask you this, though. Devil's advocate. Will loves it. If everybody did that, would it be a net positive or...
That would kind of dilute. It would dilute the actual pool.
I don't know. You know, it'd be an interesting thing to see happen. I mean, of the people that are doing it, they have flops, so they don't all make it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're failures. I have
the good ones are eyes.
I have a long list of failures. Jake, I don't know if you have any failures or not. Lee, I don't know if you have any or not, but I do.
Zero failures.
Defined failure.
Commercial fail. You know, where I didn't make any money with my efforts. I've had those and they hurt, but boy, you learn a lot. The thing is, to me, I think that a lot of people have never been taught to dream. You know, it's like it's funny to me because being an artist for a living and declaring, well, I'm going to do art for a living, is the hardest thing you can do because you don't get any support from your family or friends primarily in the beginning. In fact, you have to fight against, I was talking to a guy the other day who broke down in tears because his family, it was,
I cry daily. I try not to let anybody see.
His family doesn't support him in his choices, you know?
as an artist,
in general,
and I don't want to give too many details because I don't want him to know that
singer
No, he's an artist.
Support me. I but can here's do the accordion thing. And everything.
Bagpipes, they don't like it.
When the peanut gallery is finished. So, but the thing is, he's already done the hard part of trying to buck against the system. Why not go just a little further and at least give yourself the permission to dream about not just being the employer, but being, I mean, not just working for the employer, but being the employer. I'll bet you that if you interviewed any game studio owner or, you know, I'm talking about the small studios, the small startups, mm-hmm. and small animation people that are running teams and that are making payrolls and stuff. I bet you their story never in the beginning ever included them in the position of management that they're in. That became a byproduct of their success. You know, their wealth became, well, I just wanted to be an artist and I just started making art. And then one thing led to another and I got this idea and then I needed some people to help me. So I hired this person and I partnered with this person and then we started this company and then that thing folded or got bought by this. Anyway, they end up, and I would say the thing that they all have in common is they dared to allow themselves to dream about more. Not that it's, I agree with you. There are tons of people that are happy working for wages or, you know, working for commission. And there's nothing wrong with doing that your whole life. But there are also a lot of people who are in, you know, their 50s and 60s who have been working on commission, who are wondering, who maybe haven't saved up enough for retirement, who are wondering what they're going to do. And
this is getting really personal now.
Yeah, we're going deep. I feel like Will's going to start singing at some point.
I mean, it's true. It's something that, you know, you can, if you have a major success, you can fund your retirement in with one project. And a lot of people have, I mean, like, look at Mike Mignola, right? He didn't just work for the comic book company, right?
Yeah,
it's true. It's true. To hit the big leagues, you got to do what you're talking about. I'm trying that this year. This is the time to do it. I'm going to try doing what Will's talking about this year. It turned out all commercial work, and now I'm basically saying, all right, let's roll the dice and see what happens. And
so who's singing now?
The other thing I want to throw out there, too.
A little dream.
The other thing is don't ruin something you love by trying to make money from it as well. Mm. You know, like there's also this sort of this epidemic of this thought that if you're good at making, I see the advertisements like for GoDaddy, I think it is, or something like that. Like so-and-so's loves making tacos and she makes the best tacos in the neighborhood, turn it into a business. And now you can make tacos all day long for everybody until it kills you. Right. Buy mamastacos.com and start your business today. And I'm like, making the thing and running a business are two separate things. And oftentimes what you end up doing is spending way more time running the business than you do making the thing when you try to turn it into that. And then you're like, why did I even go down this path? Right. So I would just say, like, I think there's three options for you. For artists, keep it as a hobby, enjoy it, love it, have your stable job and have it fund this hobby, and you can afford to get the tools that you need and the resources and the tutorials and all that stuff. And at the end of the day, you might make something that's just as amazing as, you know, your favorite artist that you follow, right? Yeah. It's well within the realm of possibility.
Sure.
And then the other option is be a member of a team, you know, and be sort of like this team player and be a part of something big and use your talents to help build that thing. And the third option is make your own thing and sort of steer your own ship. And I think which of these three options that you pick, it comes down to personality, resources, and opportunity, I would say. Mm-hmm. And look at those three things. And if your personality, you know, you kind of see which one's the strongest. If personality is the strongest and it's like, I don't care if I have opportunity, don't have opportunity or resources, I'm going to go for this. I would advise that person to go for it because they're not going to be happy any mm-hmm. other way. But if there's another person who's like, you know, they just don't have that spirit. And I know your point is like more people should have that spirit about them, like do it. But if they don't have that, they might just be miserable going for it, you know? So maybe mm-hmm. it's better to just hang back and do something that really fits with the personality. So are we beating a dead horse now or no,
I don't think so at all. Okay. I think this is what's funny about this. We were not going to talk about this on the podcast today. This is like, we haven't even gotten to our topic yet, but
how'd we get here?
I'm actually thinking of leaning into this mm-hmm. because there is a question, that I have on my list from a listener of the podcast mm-hmm. That goes right along with this that we could kind of jump into a little bit. So this is from Christy. Hi guys, loving all the podcasts. I've only just jumped on board to the site and have found it amazingly helpful. I've done a little search, but I'm wondering, in case I haven't found the right thing on this, if you have any advice on building a professional team around you. I hear you often mention about teams of editors and art directors, et cetera, but wouldn't have a clue how to even start deciding whether I need these or where to find them. And so I think it goes along with what we've been talking about. And personally, the three of us, we've talked about like making sure that you are doing that which you are good at. And one of the challenges I think that creators face, if they, let's say they want to make a game, you know, or a deck of playing cards of a different type of game, or mm-hmm. they want to make a comic, or they have some sort of project that they want, they have a vision of, and then they're like, I haven't seen this in the marketplace, or I can do it better, or I can do something that, you know, that puts my twist on it. And it's a thing that bothers them as they go throughout their daily life. And as the years go by, this project that they have in their mind bugs them, as I have these projects that bug me in a good way, you know, because I'm like, I want to see this come to life. I want people to be able to experience this and have this thing and hold it and play it or read it or whatever. But it's going to be a big monumental task to get this done, and maybe I don't know exactly how to do it. And one of the things that the three of us have talked about is doing only that part of it that you're good at, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you try to do everything and you try to do the parts that you're not good at, maybe it's editing, maybe you're not good at editing like I'm not, but in order to save money, you say, well, I'm gonna not hire an editor because I'll just figure out how to do that on my own. Or maybe I'll try to figure out how to lightly program this website or whatever it is. Or maybe I'll try to do, if it's a game, maybe I'll do all the testing myself. Mm-hmm. And you can do everything. You can try to wear every hat. And some people are good at that, right? I mean, some people really do have a huge talent stack that they work from. Yeah. And it's just natural. And other people tend to be really focused. And I would say for me, my talent stack isn't as high as it could be. So I look to partner with other people and I look to include other people whenever I do a project on my own. And that seems to really help. And the thing that the advice that I would give this person is, you know, how do you build a team around you? First and foremost, it's how you treat people. Like I have friends. I have a friend who I love dearly who doesn't really know how to cultivate relationships. You know, there's a give and take. There's an accounting system, whether we know it, whether we want to admit it or not, right?
Right.
If you have a friend and your friend asks you to come and help them move and you make up an excuse, but then you're there to ask for a withdrawal on that relationship, right? pretty soon you're going to find yourself without friends. So you have to be good at managing relationships, keeping in touch with people, networking with people. And for me, I have never had a problem finding anyone that would want to work with me. I think the first challenge you have is getting really good at the thing that you do. If you become amazing at whatever it is that you're doing, your craft, mm-hmm. it's easy to get people excited to want to work with you. Wouldn't you agree? But if your art, you know, if you're the artist and you're the visual artist in the group and your artwork is lacking, it's going to be harder to get people to want to invest their time and energy in a project that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was the original question again?
How do you build a team around you? How do you find people to?
Well, I think one thing you said is really important, and that's learning how to actually reach out and ask for the team. It's taken me forever to try to, I'm only after watching both of you guys do it better than me, have I said, okay, I'm going to hire an assistant to do this other stuff that I don't need to be doing. I mean, mm-hmm. you can't do everything on every project. Otherwise you become like what Jake was talking about, where you're just a manager basically at some point of a project. You're not actually creating the artwork for it. Mm-hmm. And it took me forever because I do enjoy some of the numbers part of things and some of the managerial type things in a project, but there's only so many hours in the day, and it just took me so long to just ask for help mm-hmm. and to say, hey, you know, I'd rather be drawing than doing this part of the thing. Like, so I hired my first assistant. She just started this past week, a week ago. And oh my gosh, I got so much more done, and all my prints are all bagged and everything's all this stuff that I would have been spending hours on that doesn't really make me that much money. Mm-hmm. And it actually costs me money because now I'm not making work. I'm actually bagging prints or some other thing that, you know, I can have somebody else do. And so, you know, it's seeing other people do, things like I've seen you guys do, like even while we're doing the podcast, like somebody will be in the background of Jake's studio bagging stuff up or doing coloring on an illustration or whatever. And, you know, I don't know if I would be so open to building a team if I hadn't seen other people do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think too, I mean, there's partnerships and there's assistants and things like that. And I think if you, the way that I've done it in the past is sort of word of mouth. Like, I kind of put the word out there and I asked my friends, like, do you know anybody that would be interested in doing this sort of thing? Because if you're going to be working intimately with someone, you don't just pull someone in off the street. Like, it's, especially if they're going to, you know, if you're running it out of your home or anything like that, you kind of want to know who you're working with. And the thing that I would do too, before you spit in your hand and shake hands with them, right? Like you always test it out first and you just say, we're going to do a small project together. It's going to last 2 months. And you don't even tell them like I'm testing you out, you know, for long term, but you just kind of say, hey, let's do this thing together. And it's small. It's 2 months. You see how you guys work together. Mm-hmm. And then if it works out great, then you say, hey, let's take on something a little bit bigger. And I do that with assistants. I did that with you guys. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's how we started SVS Learn.
Right.
It was, let's teach a class one night a week.
Mm-hmm.
Online.
One class. Yeah.
One class and see, and we didn't think that it would go any further than that one class. It was like a project. Mm-hmm. Let's just have fun teaching a class online. And this was like 8 years ago.
Something like that. There. Yeah. And then Lee, we had him do a live session with us or something like that.
Yeah. And it wasn't supposed to be anything more than that.
Right.
Yeah.
And immediately we saw, oh, this guy's cool. He's energetic.
You guys saw how cool I was. How young I was.
but that's how I would actually start building out the team. And if you If you live in a college town or close to a college town, college students are always looking for little gigs for money and side stuff. And they're looking for something interesting that's not like a barista, you know, like they're looking for, I don't know if everyone is, but you could usually find someone who wants to work with an artist for, you know, one day out of the week or a couple of days out of the week or something like that. And the other thing too, it's you would not believe how, like Lee was saying, how much more you get done when you can just hand off stuff to another person and say, you know, can you just do on your to-do list today? Here's five things that I keep putting off, but they have to get done. And will you do them? And they show up, you know, 8 hours later and they're like, how's this? Does this look good? Yeah, that's awesome. You know, it's one of the best things ever. So I would look at that. And then you could also figure out as far as compensation, you know, if it is an assistant, there's ways to work it out through the college if they can get school credit. So it's almost like they're getting a free credit working for you. What I usually did was that is they would get, I'd work it out through the college that they would work for me for however long. And then, if I still needed them or they still wanted to work for me, then I would hire them on after that, after they were done doing the school thing. With a partnership, it's as easy as, you know, let's figure out a way to split whatever profits we get from this. And for now, we'll just do sweat equity, you know, and if this thing makes money, we split up whatever money it makes. There's ways to do it. And so that everybody feels like they're being well taken care of and sort of getting out of it what they're putting into it. So those are some of the ways that I would do it. The other thing too is now you are not limited to people who live in your area. Like so many people are used to doing the Zoom calls and used to working remotely that you essentially have access to the world to be able to work with people. And I hired a guy in Brazil to help me color Skyheart, and he really did incredible work, you know. And again, it started out like, here's three pages. Let's see how you do. Well, these are great.
Right.
Okay. Let's keep giving you more and more and more.
Well, should focus a little bit on, I mean, what you're talking about and what we've been talking about the past 5 minutes is like kind of the employee artist relationship. A lot of people probably aren't ready for that level of team. So I should kind of, you touched on it a second, and that's the peer group team. I'm doing a tarot deck over the next year. So I've started to buy all these tarot decks. And one of the ones that I bought was really interesting. It was a project that four artists from school did. They had met in illustration school. I guess they had some kind of bond, friendship in school. And then they decided to just make this deck of cards as a group of people. And it's just such a great thing. And then if you look at how me, Jake, and Will have done this school, same kind of thing. And so if you have a peer group of people that are, you know, around the same level you are, around the same spot in their career that you are, go ahead and strike up a conversation. Say, hey, can we make some? Can we do something as a project? And even when I was leaving school, there was a group of seven of us that kind of had this Facebook group where it was just a crit group. But then we thought, you know, we can really leverage the power of that crit group because we were all trying to advertise on our own. So we decided to do a calendar, and each of us got, you know, a little bit of work. You know, we got picked our months, and then we combined months and stuff like that. And then we put out this calendar, and I still have them. They're beautiful. And all these people ended up becoming published illustrators. And it was just such a fun project to say, you know, we were all just chatting and we were like, hey, let's make something. And then that started driving, you know, a whole different kind of relationship. Yeah. And that could have become something bigger. It could have been a school even back then or something. So you know, just looking at the people around you and saying, hey, you're doing something that I'm interested in, and maybe I'm doing something you're interested in. Let's combine forces.
I mean, that was one of my first things ever that I did quasi professionally, was the Flight Comics Anthology, which was
Kazu.
Yeah. Kazu sort of organized this thing, and he wanted to make comics. He didn't feel ready to make a graphic novel yet. Maybe he did, I don't know, but I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the idea was, let's get a bunch of like-minded individuals together and we all do a short story and we all can sort of test out our abilities as comic makers and make a little anthology. And it ended up going for 8 years. There were eight volumes of Flight, and you know, hundreds of artists ended up participating. I ended up doing four different stories for Flight, and one of those stories turned into a graphic novel series as well.
Wow.
But it just started out with, here's let's critique each other's work, let's make each other's stories as best they can be, you submit your story, we'll give you feedback. We didn't have a publisher, we didn't have an editor or anything like that. I guess Kazoo acted as editor, but we were really all editing each other's stuff. Mm-hmm. And then it was good enough that a publisher wanted to publish it. And so got a book deal, published it. And then so many of these artists have then gone on to become super successful, you know?
Yeah.
This is really fascinating to see. I would really do something like that. If you're under 25, find some people who are your, like, find some peers of yours who are really like thinking outside of the box and trying to do something, and say, hey, let's combine forces and make a thing. And it doesn't have to be like you guys are going to be doing this forever. Just let's just make a thing together. Because what that does is it strengthens that bond between you all. And then as you go on and your careers grow and expand, you have that network that you can work with these people, and they'll say, oh, I worked with you on that project, I'll hire you on for this thing. And you could do the same to them as well. So,
but what if they're just happy working for wages, Jake?
Then don't invite those people to be a part of that project.
Will has been waiting for that.
That said, though, if one of them did decide, hey, I just want to work for Disney, and they go get a job at Disney, now you've got an in at Disney, you know? Mm-hmm. Somebody says in a meeting, hey, does anybody know any artists? We just need someone to fill a spot. They'll be like, oh, I worked with this person. And
they're
and
cool.
You might be able to do that. Yeah, they're cool. They're not a butt. So
I have four pieces of advice that goes along with this idea of creating a team. By the
way.
Okay. All of a sudden. Did you just write these or
yeah, I wrote them down.
Right. So you weren't listening to a word we said.
Yeah, you're like, how can I sound smart? I'm gonna come up with a list of four things.
Okay, number one, develop a short pitch of your project. I've done this every time, where in one or two sentences you can explain exactly what you're doing without boring someone, and you can gauge their reactions. You can say, well, I'm working on this thing right now, I'm working on this game and blah blah blah, and it does this, and this, it's got a cool game mechanic, or it's got or I'm working on this graphic novel, I think it's unique, and that it tells a story about this, and you kind of give a brief little tiny piece of it. And you need that in order to get these other people that you want to be part of your team excited about it. The second thing kind of goes along with
before that. We go on to second. Yeah. I want to hear one of your pitches, your short ones.
One of my pitches? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'll pitch the book that I just funded on Kickstarter. I'm writing this is what I was telling people for a while. Yeah, I'm working on a book that teaches people the marketing side of illustration. And the tagline on it is the title is "What They Don't Teach in Art School," mm-hmm. And it's the business side.
That's perfect, because the title itself states the problem that you're solving.
Yeah, yeah,
that's good. Here's the pitch that I give for Missile Mouse, because one thing that really helps you is tabling at cons, because people kind of saunter by and they're like, do I give you any of my time or attention? And you're there and you've got to be like, hey, check out this, it's this, you know, mm-hmm. in the briefest amount of things. So for the longest time, I didn't know how to pitch Missile Mouse until I started going to cons. And what I tell people, I say, imagine Ethan Hunt from Mission Impossible. He's the main spy in Mission Impossible, the Tom Cruise character. Imagine he's a mouse and he works for this agency that exists in a Star Wars style universe. And that's essentially what Missile Mouse is. And you hear that immediately, you're like, oh, you know whether that's for you or not. And if someone likes anthropomorphic stuff, they like Star Wars, or they like spy sort of things, they're sold.
Yeah.
Easy breezy. I've got a three-step pitch technique that's in my storytelling video. You want the three-step pitch?
Give it to us.
Three-step pitch. The first step is you get one sentence, and it's what the story's about. And you only get one sentence, so it has to be right to the point. Step two is what makes this unique or interesting, and you get two sentences there. So you said three sentences, and they should be bring people on board real quick. And then step three is you get 3 to 4 sentences, and that's any other details that support those first two. So you have a total of about 6 to 8 sentences, and you should be able to get your project nailed in those eight or so sentences. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how specific that is, because when people are pitching, they all of a sudden get lost in, oh, I want to give you the details first, but I haven't oriented you to what the project actually is.
That's right.
And so using Wills, he was perfect. It's a book about what you never learned in art school. Or no, it's an instructional book. That's the kind of first thing. And then it's what you never learned in art school. That's what makes it interesting. It's all the kind of the hidden stuff. And then a couple of detailed sentences about it. And same with your Missile Mouse one. And so it's a really, really effective way if you guys want to pitch stories to do that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so second on my list is ask the person that you want to be part of your team if they know anybody that would fit who you're looking for. Don't ask them.
Your guard will come up. Their guard will automatically, like, do I have time? Do I want to commit?
Allow them to wonder why you didn't consider and ask them directly. Maybe they'll fight to get on your team. So you could say it's... I wouldn't say it's manipulative as much as it is. It's a psychological.
It's a test.
Yeah, it's a test. There you go. Because what you're doing is you're not directly asking someone, so they don't feel threatened. Like, I have to give this person an answer.
Right.
You're saying, hey, I'm really looking for someone who could do this thing. If you know anybody who might be interested in doing this, will you send them my way?
That actually protects both of you.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because it makes it so that you're not being so bold as to, like, you know, demand that they entertain this opportunity that you've given them.
Right.
And they're not on the spot. Yeah, I love that.
They're not on the spot. They don't have to, like, come up with anything.
Yeah.
And it also, like, it breaks, it sort of helps. If they recommend themselves, it shows that they're really interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a qualifier in a lot of ways.
I love that. I love that.
I like that, Will.
Number three on the list is...
You couldn't have thought of that on your own, right? Like, you got that from someone else?
I'll never tell. Number three is if you decide to partner with it. So people partner because they don't have money, right? If you had tons of money, you'd just pay for... You just pay people the service. You keep 100% of the company, right?
Yeah.
But you pay people in percentage because you don't have money. And in addition to that, I would say if it's not percentage, you often want to incentivize people to be able to work harder because they're going to get a better payout. So even if it's not a percentage, it could be in bonuses and structures and things like that. But you really should sit down with your partners, if they are partners, and at the beginning of the project, as before you even incorporate and send off your articles of incorporation or your operating agreement, talk to them and say, I want to have a talk with you, and I want to be open about what we're about to do. And this is something that most people skip. They just go in, and both people, if it's a two-person partnership or if it's a three, everyone kind of has their own vision of what the project is. But if you don't have a meeting of the minds, maybe one partner's thinking it's going off in this direction, another one's going off the other. And you really should sit down and tell each other what you're afraid of the other person doing. I'm like afraid.
That. I think you should also write this stuff down.
You should write it down. You should, but you should really tell each other, hey, I'm afraid that you're not going to deliver. You know, you're the artist and I'm afraid that you're not going to actually do what you said you're going to do and give me the best artwork. I mean, it's just a fear that mm-hmm. I have that hits my brain. And you know, my wife and I did this before we got married. We sat down, we told each other what we were afraid of the other person doing because we were older in life. I mean, I got married last year. And so this is something that is just a really good thing to do.
It's hard to do though. It's hard to direct saying things directly without thinking you're offending somebody.
Right.
That's really hard to do, but I agree. I think it's great.
We call it the monkey screech. The monkey says to me, whispers in my ear and says, you might be thinking this, or you might be planning this, or you might be wanting to do this. And it's a way of saying, I don't think you're going to do that, but I get this monkey screech saying, well, he's going to do that. She's going to do that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a really good thing to do because you'll learn about your partners. You'll learn what they're afraid of on you. And that's valuable information. Because now you have to live up. You have to prove that you're not going to do the thing that they're afraid of.
I have a fear that you guys are going to keep postponing our recording sessions when they're scheduled.
Do we want to get into that right now?
Just to let the audience know, our typical Tuesday is, hey guys, are we recording today? And then a chat from Will Terry comes back 5 minutes later. I'm in Colorado today. I just am hiking, so it's going to have to be.
Wow.
Yeah. It's always one of us is up to something.
Uh-huh.
Oh, man. Was it today we said we'd do it?
Yeah.
And I'm having all my windows replaced. I can't do it today.
If Lee cancels, it's because he's at Home Depot. And he's getting more building supplies to fix up the house.
That's true.
My last one on the list is pay your people. I have a friend who he's like, I can't get anyone to come to my house to work on something, or I can't get someone to work with me on this project or that project. He's burned all of his bridges because he tries to get people for below where they even want to be. Wow. He beats them up so bad. And if you beat up your partners, guess what? You're not going to have a team around you eventually. I have Ian working with me on, he was working with me on Little Heroes. And then he's now working with me on Well-Fed Illustrators. And we've already started working on the next project, which I haven't really announced yet. So I'm not going to, but that's a sign that you're doing something right. Is if you can keep your team from one project to another, and if you can't, how do you tell someone how in this podcast do we tell people, hey, if you suck, stop sucking? You know, like if you mistreat people, you're going to be unsuccessful in creating teams to work with you on projects. I mean,
I think to know if you are that person, you got to have some honest conversations and ask some honest questions, you know?
Yeah.
Probably something like that.
Anyway.
That's good. So the four are learn how to pitch.
And it's the way you pitch to somebody, asking them if they know someone instead of just asking them directly.
Ask if they know someone, hash out the particulars.
Uh-huh.
And
tell them what you're afraid of. Yeah.
And then treat them nicely. Is that the last one?
Yeah.
I like it. I think that's good.
Perfect note to end on.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's wrap it up. That was good. I guess next episode will air in 2021. So thank you for joining us this year. Really, this has been a highlight doing these things with you two guys. And I love it. I love it.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
Can't wait to record another 24 episodes next year. So All right, I'll take us out. Thanks for joining us, everybody. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and Jake Parker. You can find Will Terry's work at willterry.com. Also follow him on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White can be found, his illustration portfolio is leewhiteillustration.com. And you can find his work at leewhiteillo on Instagram. And I'm Jake Parker. My website is mrjakeparker.com. And you can find me on Instagram at Jake Parker. Podcast is produced by Daniel Tu. That's danieltu.co. That's his website. Special thanks to Daniel for throwing this together and doing the best that he can with what we give him. Podcast shared by Lisa Fott. Special thanks to her. And special thanks to David Broad. Did I mess that up? David Bod. Broad.
That's right.
What is wrong with my mouth? Special thanks to David Broad for all of his help and being our producer here at svslearn.com. All right. If you like this episode, please share it around. Subscribe to it on iTunes and leave a review. We would love to hear what you think. You can subscribe to it on other podcasting platforms as well. Stitcher, I think, is one we're trying to get on too. But if you're wanting to join in on this particular discussion, go over to svslearn.com, click on the forum link at the top of the website, and join our forums, where we've had a thread devoted specifically to this episode. So chime in over there and let us know your thoughts. And I think that's it, everybody. Thank you. We'll see you next time.